Join me, Dr. Kathy Weston, for my podcast series, Get a Grip, brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. In each podcast, I help unpick some of the trickier questions relating to how we raise children today. How do we talk to children about mental health? How can we make sure our children engage safely with the digital world? Whose responsibility is the mental health education of our children, teachers or parents? These podcasts get me talking and you thinking. I've reached out to today's thought leaders and main researchers in this area and asked them their views on the areas where we need to get a grip. Charles Fadell is a global education thought leader and author, futurist and inventor, founder and chairman of the Center for Curriculum Redesign, visiting scholar at Harvard, member president's council at Olgan College of Engineering, chair education committee at the OECD, co-author of Artificial Intelligence in Education, Four-Dimensional Education, best-selling 21st Century Skills, and has just authored the book, which I'm going to chat to him now about, Education for the Age of AI. And a very warm welcome, Charles. How are you?
Great, Kathy. Thank you. And you?
Very well. Thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk to me today. I first came across your work at a big Cognitas conference. It was a big sort of boarding school event, and you were talking about sort of curricula and the advances made in AI, and it was mind-blowing. And I just came away from it thinking, this is unbelievable. You really mapped out a new world within education that I thought everyone needed to know about. And ever since that time, I've been sort of going up to people and saying, have you heard of your work? Are you aware of the center, you know, that you work within? And then I noticed that you had published a brand new book, Education for the Age of AI. And I just grabbed the chance to really talk to you about that book in particular, but also to bring your work a little bit, you know, to parents, to educators, to a slightly wider audience, if that's okay.
Those are very kind words, Kathy. Yes, I'm very appreciative of this chance to propagate the thoughts. Yes, thank you.
So tell us a little bit, perhaps people who aren't familiar with your work, tell us about what your long-standing interest has been in AI and education, but also about the work of your center that people may not be familiar with.
Well, certainly. So first of all, from a personal perspective, I studied quantum physics and electrical engineering and started an AI company on neural networks right as they were going out of favor to the benefit of symbolic AI. And so that startup didn't last long. We were able to only compute three layers of artificial neurons at the time. Whereas now, with 100 million fold improvement in processing power, in computing power, we can compute thousands of layers. And so timing is everything. And yeah, it took an extra 30 years, only that. So my window was off. So that's been a longstanding interest in AI. Though my career took me into semiconductors, where I experienced Moore's law and its exponential process, then where I transitioned from technology to education policy, because there's only so much fun you can have pushing more bits faster. You know, at some point you want to do something that's more purposeful, and that's education. And so in that transition, I went to Cisco, the networking company, and that's where the transition occurred. And I wrote a book called 21st Century Skills, which became a moniker used worldwide. That's great. And then after I left Cisco about 12 years ago, I started a center to basically making education more relevant. That's our tagline. Because I'm a technologist, I could see the progress that was being made, not just in AI, but on other fronts. And I could see how this was impacting education, and education was not reacting fast enough. So I figured, okay, well, that's my passion. And I bring a different lens because I was an engineer. We pay a lot of attention to precision and specificity in our conversations. And that's how the center started with, you know, working on its frameworks and its ontologies. And here we are.
And that's the Center for Curriculum Redesign, CCR, it's known as, and that's based in Harvard, is that correct?
Although I taught at Harvard for 7 or 8 years, the center is not based at Harvard, it's based in Boston. and meaning Boston, the Massachusetts variant, not the one you have in the UK.
Absolutely. And we know, as you say, we'll come to that, but your website, that center, is enormously important for educators all over the world, because you even produce updates on chapters, on new thinking. You know, it's a lovely thing to sort of where educators can keep their finger on the pulse in terms of what's happening across a whole array of different areas.
Well, thank you. It's a little bit a software mindset where you're constantly sending out revisions, right? And so same thing here. There's no reason why the knowledge has to remain so static. Every time there's a new piece of information, we release it. Again, that's also part of an engineering mindset where you're not trying to debate ad infinitum whether you have the right solution up front, but you come up with an 80-20 rule, get things going, and then you can refine as you continue.
So let's talk about your book, Education for the Age of AI. First of all, may I say, the way in which it's written, it's not just for people who understand AI, who have, you know, existing opinions about it or expertise. I mean, I have thoroughly enjoyed it as someone who knows relatively little about that area and as a parent. It's a very exciting book, and I love the way that you've laid it out. I've never received a book before that has an executive summary, sort of summarizing the key areas, because you really do distill very complex concepts into something where you go, wow, you know, you need your highlighter to go, this is mindset changing, you know, it's really exciting. So tell us how that book came about, because it seems to be part of an enormous collaboration of sorts.
Well, thank you, Kathy. Again, kind words on your part. Well, you know, the executive summary, that's a reflection on the fact that I've spent 25, 30 years, roughly speaking, of my career in the corporate world. And I have dealt with people who have even lower attention spans than I do. And so, you know, you don't necessarily want to read the entire book to get the gist of it. And then you may want to decide on specific chapters to get into, but not necessarily read everything sequentially top to bottom. We rarely have that kind of time nowadays. So it makes it easier for people to go by chunks. Now, yes, it is a collaboration of me and my colleagues at the center. And this is where you see how complex the sort of task becomes, because you need to bring in educators of various types. You know, we had an anthropologist, a mathematician, a communication expert, myself, which is a bit of a jack of all trades, and an AI expert, all to write that book in its complexity, in its completeness. The trick here is that we had to come up with something that was readable by everybody and yet did not oversimplify. So as Einstein said, simplify, but just enough. Don't go into simplistic. And that's the difficult balance we try to strike. So I'm very pleased to hear that you as a parent were able to read it and made sense of it.
Absolutely. And there's a lovely paragraph, if you don't mind, that I'd like to read out in the introduction, that the core question throughout this text is, what does it mean to be human in today's world? AI is painted as a mirror positioned in front of us and reflecting back who we are. The newest innovations of AI are carefully covered in the book, but what remains unknown is also acknowledged in a humble way. We do not have a shortage of well-formulated educational strategies in the world. However, we are lacking the capabilities to embed these strategies into the reality of everyday teaching and learning in every school and classroom across the globe. We cannot keep everything that was taught earlier and simultaneously add every new demand. We have to understand required trade-offs and admit that in curriculum, less can be more. To be able to prioritize what is essential for the future of teaching and learning is more important today than ever, as demonstrated in this book. So I thought that was a lovely summary of, it's an acknowledgement of what we know where we are now, but it's also a plea within the book, you know, to get with it, you know, that we really do need to renew and refresh what we're doing and to at least, as a minimum, reflect on what our offering is in schools.
Well, indeed. And with a sense of urgency, if I may add, you know, you look around us, we have a burning planet, we have wars, we have pandemics, etc. We have no shortage of difficulties. And you could argue that the way we have handled them is really because of a lapse in education for the past 50 years, because the people in power now are the ones who were educated at the time. And so what do we see? We see a lack of ethics everywhere. We see a lack of courage on the part of politicians. We see a lack of curiosity and critical thinking on the part of the general public, and on, all sorts of things that should have been trained a long time ago. But even further, even just on the knowledge side, think there are three words that would have saved us trillions of dollars had they been taught in mathematics. Just three words equals trillions of dollars saved. The three words are deceiving, then explosive. That's how you'd characterize an exponential. So imagine for a second if politicians and leaders and so on had not just learned the mathematics, the algebraic formulation of an exponential, but also its meaning, its concept. An exponential is deceiving, then explosive. Had they known that and really kept it in their bones, they would have realized that they cannot dilly-dally when there's a pandemic or when there's a situation that's exponential like global warming. The earlier you react, the faster you stop the exponential rise, the propagation. And so, yes, it is deceiving at first, and that's why you should not be lulled by a sense of false security just because you only have 18 cases this weekend. Because you should know that next weekend there will be 180, the following weekend 1,800, and the following weekend you shut down the airports. That's what the sort of things that we should have learned a long time ago, and we haven't. So what I've described here is modernizing the what of education in terms of knowledge, given my exponential example, but also in terms of competencies, meaning skills and character qualities and meta-learning, as I described earlier.
That's right. And you talk about the need for learning to be modernized. You talk about those key concepts, those dimensions of character, knowledge, metacognition. These are tangible concepts that you talk about in great detail in the book, you know, spelling out what we mean by them. You know, what do we mean by a lot of those character traits and dispositions and what the applicability of that in, you know, the skill set that is required in modern life?
Well, yes. And that's one of the very first things we started doing. What surprised me when I started getting involved with education and psychology is how it was the proliferation of terms, of taxonomies, and so on. And very often they were imprecise, hard to peg down. And so we did a vast sweep of more than 100 different frameworks on skills and character, etc. And we synthesized them and we brought up explicit definitions down to the sub-competency level, etc. Because it's a moot point to say, is AI more or less creative than a human? What you want to say is, what are the components of creativity or the components of critical thinking, etc.? And can AI do these tasks related to each one of these components? Rather than having these broad debates about what is intelligence and is AI intelligent, that's an unresolvable debate since we cannot even say what is intelligence for humans.
That's right. So you clarify some of those definitions, don't you, what we're talking about?
Precisely. Precisely. When you go to the level of task, then you can say, can it do it or can it not? That's much easier to define than a more philosophical conversation.
And some of the sort of the basic fears around AI, let's talk about some of them, the myths, and debunk a few of them as well. You know, often I meet classroom teachers who fear AI, who believe there's no, we should not even go there, you know, that we're going to be, that it's impossible to come to terms with how it might transform teaching and learning quickly. And also concerns perhaps in schools that about employability, what does it mean for young people's jobs, all sorts of things. What are the most common fears, the anxieties that you have met about AI that you'd like to quickly debunk?
Well, I don't know if quickly is possible. You have asked three questions simultaneously. Right. I'll try to answer them. So the first one is really about humans in general, not just teachers. So humans in general have been always concerned about being replaced, whether it's Luddites, you know, with the industrialization era. You know, that we have quotes going back to Socrates talking about, you know, how slaves would be replaced if the tool could do the work by itself. That fear has been with humanity for a long time. Another problem of that fear is that we tend to anthropomorphize things greatly. And so the moment something vaguely resembles what we can do, like, for example, Eliza back in the 70s, a chatbot that was able to answer in a very mechanical sort of way, everyone just goes crazy and says, oh my God, that's it, we're doomed. And we've seen many, many cycles of this in AI, probably every 15 or so, 20 years, there's a new cycle of, oh my God, we're doomed. And it sells press-wise, so it's easy to make it foam and panic people. And it's much harder to, of course, realize that, wait a second, Eliza was just, this was just a robotic answer. And we were anthropomorphizing it, you know, enormously, even with very, very, very crude answers. So, you know, every new phase has its own, you know, hype cycle, as the Gartner Group calls it. And the hype dies eventually, and then the real work continues. Now, of course, we make progress, but the progress is nowhere near the hype that gets generated in the moment. Recall, for example, when Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue. That was the end of human intelligence, we read in the papers. Well, no, not quite. So here we are. And so every new phase has the same fears that resurface. Now, when it comes to teachers, beyond the fact that they're humans and they face the same fears as everybody else, they also have to deal with, okay, what does this mean for me in my classroom? The immediate impact of this phase of AI was students being able to use a tool that synthesizes information. And it caught everybody by surprise how good that was, because the past phase with basic machine learning was very narrowly focused on specific games or problems to solve, whether it was protein folding or winning at Go. These were very specific data sets. But with language models accessing, you know, enormous amounts of information, now it's pretty much the entire visible corpus of human information. I stress visible because it's only 5% of the total. But still, big enough so that it can answer seemingly intelligently. And I say really seemingly because it's a giant statistical engine that's just going through the corpus and answering literally as the probability of preceding words dictates. Okay. So as a teacher, like, okay, what do I do with this? My students are capable of coming up with reasonably good essays. Well, we've had an antecedent for this. It's called computers in mathematics. You can actually compute all sorts of things with that beast, you know, the computer. We've had an antecedent of this with mechanical devices, trucks, cranes, etc. They can certainly do jobs that we can't do. And somehow we managed to say, okay, well, great, I'm going to use the tool. So the best approach is to say, okay, well, this tool exists the same way that MATLAB or Mathematica exist. How can we use it to automate the routine procedures and force the students to pay attention to how you ask the questions, how do you refine and make precise your thinking? And then on the other side of the answer, how do you validate the answer? It's actually tougher than simply writing the essay, in my opinion, because now you have to be more at the metacognitive level and you have to know what you're talking about so that you can tell whether the AI knows what it's talking about. Much tougher. It's very much like an open book exam, which are notoriously harder than traditional exams because it's not a question of memory. It's a question of deep understanding.
That's right. I love that point. It's about refining one's own thinking. And there's so much potential to actually create more sophisticated and refined arguments using AI as that classroom aid, potentially.
Precisely. Exactly. And so, of course, the usual fears of teachers being replaced and all of that are highly exaggerated. What is a lot wiser to talk about, of course, is how to augment the teachers, a bit like an exoskeleton would help you carry heavier loads. This is a mental exoskeleton for you, or an exobrain, to be precise. So,
yeah, I love that quotation in the book. AI is a mind's exoskeleton. It's so clear in terms of, you know, it's very helpful.
I should have called it exobrain in the book, actually, but thank you.
So as a parent, I just wanted to share something. I've got a 17-year-old. He wanted to do law at university, and then he was worried about AI. Would AI replace the whole legal profession, able to spot different offences in a case study or do the analysis that a barrister might require to do for court? And when we had a little look at your book together, on chapter two, that's all about occupations, you talk about all the sort of, you know, the exaggerated predictions about which jobs would become basically redundant or which skills over time. And one of the things that really struck us was that we came away with feeling very positive, because you said that those students, he absorbed this message, those students with AI capabilities are likely to outperform those who do not, emphasizing the importance of integration into professional environments, that AI is enhancing for a professional or for a student who's learning. It's never going to be that replacement. So it sort of shifted our thinking a little bit, because we feel like it's a wave that you need to ride rather than sort of avoid, if that makes sense.
Exactly. Totally. And that's how you would view any technology tool that humans have invented, from the flint to, you know, the wheel to whatever. We've always ridden our inventions. Now, of course, this is viewed as more challenging because these are cognitive capabilities. But the same reasoning apply. You still have to figure out how to ride these cognitive abilities. So, for instance, for a lawyer, the basic point is we should not confuse tasks with jobs. The job is indeed a succession of tasks, but first and foremost, the meta level of gluing all of these tasks together itself is a complicated, highly context-dependent activity, not easy to automate. Second, even if you can automate one of the tasks of a lawyer, for example, just for fun, if you were to watch Netflix Attorney Woo, I don't know if your son has watched it, but you know, there's this autistic Korean attorney who just has in her memory the entire corpus of law. Well, she can see all sorts of relationships that general people cannot see just because she has it all in her memory. Well, that's a language model. It has the corpus of law in its memory, a specialized one, of course, a specialized language model. And so as an attorney, it'll be wise of you to figure out how you can leverage its capability to see all of these interconnections and craft a strategy to take advantage of the possibilities that it finds. Lastly, you know that for better or for worse, attorneys are rather creative at some of the claims they bring up. And well, it takes a creative mind to think, okay, well, there's this ambiguity there that I'm going to exploit. Ambiguity is not something that a statistical language model is going to do very well.
Yeah, that's incredibly reassuring. All the law schools around the country will be quoting you there.
Okay, I'm not sure I wanted to have that positive of an effect on law schools.
So we have other questions submitted by some head teachers, if that's okay for you, Charles. Are there any particular areas of education where AI is going to make the bigger or the smaller difference?
So one of the big differences, and it's a positive one, I think will emerge, is the ability to create the nurse equivalent to the doctor for education. If you think about it, very many countries do not have teachers, do not have enough teachers, do not have enough good teachers. Even developed countries have deficits in types of teachers. I heard last week a statistics about the UK and how many mathematics teachers were being replaced by substitutes that didn't have a math background. Well, okay, so what do you do then? Well, imagine for a moment if you had an AI capable of helping that substitute teacher or that non-existent teacher or that 15-year-old kid who's forced to be a teacher because he or she is the only educated person in the village or whatever. And then you have an AI that can help. And so it takes that nurse equivalent to a doctor equivalent, a general practitioner equivalent. And that would be wonderful to help to compensate for the deficit in the numbers and qualities of teachers. That would be one huge advantage, helping people boost their capabilities. And you'll see in the book this example of consultants in a prestigious consulting firm where the bottom half of consultants in terms of capabilities was boosted more than the top half because they had already saturated, in a sense, how much they could be boosted. Whereas the bottom half, the one lagging in performance, got boosted significantly by the AI. And so all of this is goodness for the teacher profession. It will help them develop. It will help shoulder them. It will help them automate some of their more difficult tasks. And it will not easily or ever replace the social interaction that's needed for learning, as we all know is necessary. That said, if you've watched the series Humans, you will note in the first season how the little girl was loving her robot's patience because the robot could repeat the same story for her 5,000th time, whereas mommy was tired after a day of work and didn't want to read the same story for the 5,001th time. So there are situations where robots will impact the emotional aspect of our dealings. And it's going to be a fascinating thing to figure out, you know, how we deal with it and where we continue to find our differential advantage. The sobering aspect is that it's probably not going to be a giant hiding place. Cognitive, affective, and psychomotor are all going to be affected. However, that's looking at it at a very, very big grain level. The devil is in the details, and that's what we try to do repeatedly in the book, go into the details to understand where and how.
That's right. The lovely thing about the book is that a teacher can take, for example, the chapter on belonging, which is an incredibly important protective asset, isn't it, for children and pupils' mental health, and understand what the heck we're talking about by that term. Because, you know, you have to understand the knowledge needs to come first, doesn't it? We need to be very careful about the quality of knowledge that we, you know, are absorbing before we use AI to good effect.
Well, exactly. This is where, of course, teachers shine, and this is how they can personalize education all the better, right? On the other side of what we just discussed in terms of teacher aids, we're also going to have intelligent tutoring systems that will also help them tailor the education and decide on the proportion of teacher-guided versus machine-guided learning for the student and remain involved in the right ratios. So, but more generally speaking, what the world of AI implies for education is that in addition to knowledge, skills, character, and meta-learning, you have to start personalizing and pay attention to what we've always tried to do, but it's really hard to do. Meaning motivation, identity, agency, and purpose, right? The motivation to both extrinsic and intrinsic, the identity and belonging, agency and growth mindset, and purpose and passion are all the more highlighted in a world where you are working with AI.
That's right. That's right. And I think there was a teacher who got in touch asking about, well, she was commenting that she had been able to use interactive AI models to generate wonderful lesson plans for children with special educational needs. Another teacher got in touch to say he was a PE teacher. He'd redesigned his curricula based on sort of submitting lots of interesting OECD reports on physical development and what it needs to look like into the next few years. And it provides an exciting, it ignites thinking, doesn't it? And hopefully, you know, a lot of that material will be of higher quality than it would have otherwise been.
Certainly it will be. And of course, it depends on how the prompts are written, what data sets they're using, etc. So it's not quite as, it's a little bit brittle, but it will improve over time. But the consequence, though, is that teachers will spend less and less time on the design aspect, you know, of the lesson plan the day or the week before, and much more time on the delivery aspects. So customization, localization, personalization of those lesson plans. And that's a good thing, I suspect, because we're asking them to do more and more complicated tasks of weaving together modernized content, core concepts, competencies, formative assessments, projects, etc., it just breaks anyone's back. And so with these tools and the right curriculum designers, we'll be able to generate this sort of thing rather fast at high quality, and then the teachers can customize for their local environments.
So a teacher who loves your work said to tell you he's, you know, has redesigned what he's doing in school based on your work as well. That's very exciting. He said, have you identified any educational settings where you could say that there's examples of really great, exciting practice, you know, best practice in this area? When you think about sort of the use of AI in education, can you think of an amazing school that has it kind of, that could be an inspiration to others?
So first of all, it's too early to say that anyone has done it right at the classroom level. There are myriads of experiments, as he knows for sure. And AI is progressing still very, very fast. You can ask the same prompt 2 days in a row and get different answers. So things are not stable enough to know exactly what is a fabulous practice or not. So first of all, I encourage everyone to continue trying. You learn how to manipulate the tool by using the tool. So that's number one. Second, just about best practices in general. What we are after at my center is not just a bunch of isolated examples. We welcome the fact that some of these are deliberate efforts, but we also add the following words. We want them to be systematic, we want them to be comprehensive, and we want them to be demonstrable. And that's valid for the competencies. So, of course, around the world, you have teachers who try to teach curiosity or critical thinking or ethics, etc. But no one, as far as we were able to determine, does it at scale with the level of rigor being systematic, comprehensive, and demonstrable that we demand. So that's really the challenge. It's not a one-off idea or a cool thing here or there. It's really to scale that across the entire system.
I think one of the things that I was interested in and picked up in your book about critical thinking and also, you know, boosting children's emotional intelligence or creating a climate at school for the increase of emotional intelligence is that it's about the whole school. It's everything has to be holistic, comprehensive. It's about school culture. It's about designing, you know, the classroom, the type of questions that are going to open up a child's thinking, that are going to increase cognitive flexibility. There was a very exciting series of pages in the book about that concept and about how I was thinking about how AI can support those efforts, if you like.
I don't know that AI specifically supports those efforts, because I view them as efforts of leadership and open-mindedness more than something that's automatable or as an extra tool. Meaning very often we hope that the tool is going to help us do something that we should be doing as a panacea. And so there's nothing that's going to replace the leadership of a school that decides, you know what, we're going to teach in the following ways. And yes, we will use AI, but we'll use a variety of other tools, mechanical or otherwise. So I still view this as a question of school leadership and system leadership, you know, from the policymakers downwards. So you have the policymakers who need to accept that we need new curricula. You have the departments of education or ministries that need to redesign them more courageously than they have. We have the quality assurance side, the assessments people that need to accept that they have to change the goalposts, otherwise they're freezing the system in place. Then you have to have the school leadership willing to embrace the fact that this is a modern world. Let's not spend the entire 21st century to develop 21st century skills. That would be ridiculous. Then we have teachers who are trained in certain ways and are an interesting mixture of politically liberal, but educationally conservative, you know, perhaps rightly so at times, meaning prove it to me, I'm tired of the next fad. But also sometimes, you know, the world is changing, please adapt, we all have to, why wouldn't you? So that's, you know, the challenge is at multiple levels in the system. Now, any one of these levels has some leeway in making some change. Let's call it 20-25% leeway. But to have 100% change, all of this has to happen. All layers have to work in unison. And that's a tougher challenge.
I remember watching you at the conference that I referred to earlier, where you demonstrated a sort of an optimal curricula. I remember you highlighting key activities that we knew. I think it was scouting and sailing as particular activities. I can't quite remember the context, but it was enormously exciting. I mean, I'm not a head teacher, but I thought if I was a head teacher, I would seriously be looking at what you had demonstrated there. Can you just tell us a little bit about what that was about?
Sure. So one of the facets that we need to develop for this modern age is adaptability. So you start looking at which disciplines are best suited to teach you adaptability. It turns out that health and physical education happens to be one of those disciplines if you use some specific activities. So in that case, sailing is one that actually fosters quite a bit of adaptability. Everything is always changing around you. The sun, the clouds, the waves, the currents, the wind, obviously, etc., etc. So that is one type of activity that fosters the development of in-the-moment adaptability. Another one, from a completely different angle, would be improv. Same thing. You have no idea what's coming at you. You have to react fast. So you see how if you start thinking in terms of what are the competencies that are needed, then you can start thinking of which disciplines, branches, or topics are most suited to develop that particular competency.
Yeah, it was so exciting to hear that. I haven't forgotten about it. Okay, next question from a head teacher. Can AI help shape a more equitable world in any way?
Oh, that's everyone's hope, always, right, about education in general. I think this is a very complicated conversation because, first of all, you have to look at the sources of inequities, right? So some of them are fairness and redistribution, right? Some of them are, so in other words, the complement to that would be greed and selfishness. And so how do you make humans less greedy, less selfish, more giving, more tolerant of others, etc.? Education always has a role to play, no question, but it's a very long game. And that long game is always disrupted by what I would call sociopaths of various types. And they have no compulsion, no problem disrupting systems for their own benefit. And so the trick here is to figure out a mechanism so that the sociopaths are not followed. And that implies a very, very, very serious, dogged effort on education so that people know how to reject them rather than let them gain power. Because once they do, that 0.1% of sociopaths makes the rest of our existences miserable. And in a sense, they give us all more work than we wish to have just because they're always destroying, destroying, destroying. It's a lot easier to destroy than to create and build.
Absolutely. Hear, hear. Okay, here's a fab question from you. What is your prediction, Charles, for how education will look different in 20 years' time?
Okay, well, I hope I'll still be around in 20 years for someone to challenge me on whether my answer was correct or not. I think, first of all, that the pictures we see everywhere bemoaning the fact that we still have classrooms and benches is completely wrong. So the fact that we will still have benches is not a problem. The question is, how are they organized and what are the activities around these benches, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think that you will still recognize the classroom. It will just have more fluidity, as we've seen already done in classrooms, meaning they're not always pointed in the same direction. Sometimes we have specific areas where we do group activities, et cetera, et cetera. It's not visibly very different. And that's what fools people. They're expecting a visible difference rather than a deep qualitative difference. And that's why it's so hard for politicians to fund education, because they want to see an impact in 2 years and the impact better be visible. So it's a lot easier to bring in a bunch of flat screens and dump them everywhere than to change the depth of what's not so easy to discern and ascertain, which is, you know, a much, much better education. So this much better education would be the right blend between teacher-led, AI-led, student-led, you know, and this triumvirate between all three and how they would interplay with each other.
Okay. There are educators who say AI should be banned, others who say it should be mandatory in all lessons. Where do you stand on this? I think we know where you stand on it a little bit, but...
Well, that's why we wrote the third chapter on wisdom. The whole point of it is being moderate in one's opinion. In other words, the golden mean. There's, of course, validity in saying it shouldn't be just used glibly everywhere. And there's also validity in also saying, well, but it should be used because it's a reality, the same way we use calculators and spreadsheets and internet access, you know, search, etc. Of course, it has to be used. But it doesn't have to be over abused in either direction. And that's where these old conversations in education are very tiring. That's why we wrote this chapter on wisdom, saying enough of the or. It's really an and, and it's really thoughtful, reasoned and conversations we need to have, not these parochial, if not religious fights, dogmatic religious fights.
What is your hope for the book? Who are you hoping reads it beyond maybe the, or, you know, the audience of educators and fans of your work? What is it that your ultimate ambition for the book, if you could map it out?
Well, in a perfect world, all levels of education would want to pay attention to how they can impact the system. So you have the policymaker level that realizes, wow, we really need to change the standards and the curriculum. You have the school administrator and leadership level saying, wow, we really need to listen carefully and figure out how we can help our teachers. Teacher level saying, okay, I have to accept this is a new reality. How do I make the best of it and really leverage myself rather than cower away? Then you have the parents who should think, wow, this is a new world my kids are going to be living in. It behooves me to understand what it's going to be about and how can I do my part in how I educate my child. The student should also take a look and say, okay, it's my future after all. I have the maturity now that I'm a teenager to understand what's at stake. Partial maturity. We've all been teenagers. We've had teenagers. We know it's all partial maturity. But nevertheless, mature enough to understand, okay, I need to figure out what how I use AI in this modern world. And then the Gordian knot of it all is the assessments people. The assessments people have to free up the system. The longer they keep things stagnant and static, the less we can adapt to the new world. And again, we're not saying in any way, dump every assessment, dump it all, no assessments. We're not the least bit radical. But we consider ourselves ambitiously incremental or incrementally ambitious, whichever you prefer. And so the point here is to reform the assessments, to broaden what gets measured, to new disciplines, modernized disciplines, competencies, etc., so that we can actually teach these things and they actually matter for the teachers, for the school administrators, and they be in sync with what the policymakers need to do.
Yeah, so the whole ecosystem needs to wake up, pay attention. Everyone has a role to play.
Precisely.
There's a beautiful quotation in your book, which I've highlighted for myself, that the broadening of perspective is a hallmark of wisdom, which involves the ability to see beyond one's own perspective and consider the greater good. While exposing learners to new perspectives, it's important to allow independent reflection. So you're talking about, you know, there's a whole chapter on that. But I think for school leaders, it's exciting to take that definition of wisdom and to have the courage, as you imply within the book, to look at the much, much bigger picture and, you know, to delve into these areas with courage, I think, with their colleagues and to read your book. You know, it's a great inset book, isn't it? Everyone, they should all be reading it and using it for springboards, for conversations about how to redesign the curricula within their school, to do things differently?
Well, yes. But, you know, just the idea is 1% of the work. The other 99% is the sweat, right? So that's where I hope that they continue looking at what we're working on, because from an education engineering perspective, as we call it, we continue developing curricula, standards, etc., so that they can be used. We're not asking every single group worldwide to come up with their own implementation of every single aspect. We're asking them to, you know, leverage what has been done by others and just stand on the shoulders of each other.
That's right. That's right. They can, you know, I think one of the last questions to ask you, which ties into that, is how can educators engage with the work that you do at your center? So what is the best way in which they can sort of use the work that you've developed if they're a classroom teacher or a school leader?
Well, so we have materials at several levels of abstraction or granularity. We have standards, we have curricula, we have courseware even. And so depending on where you are, we have EdTech tools, we have thought leadership pieces. So depending on where you are in the chain, you can decide what type of material is useful to you, number one. Number two, we tend to work with jurisdictions that are either advanced or wish to advance. So, and they range from, you know, the top PISA jurisdictions to also the likes of Brazil and South Africa and others who want to try harder. South Australia is a wonderful example of a jurisdiction that has the right leadership and the right wherewithal to move forward. So it's perfectly possible. It's just a question of political courage very often.
And what about your relationship with the UK in general? Have you had your ideas welcomed here? I know I came across you at a UK conference, but...
That's an interesting question. I do not really know actually what the standing is in any particular jurisdiction. I mean, the basic framework has been translated into 23 languages, but I have no idea. It's too diffuse to know to what extent a given idea has had an impact. And I have to admit, I'm not particularly interested personally in self-promotion. It's really about the ideas and, you know, their propagation. And so I'm just hoping that we're all building this cathedral, that we're building it from, you know, a very, very healthy base perspective, and that this is not about recognition. This is, you know, on our deathbed, we're not going to say, oh, I'm glad that I got this medal or this these three letters after my name. It's really about whether or not we made a better world, right? We did our part to make a better world. And I'm going to take you back to what you were saying about, in essence, you, in so many words, you were talking about the tragedy of the commons. That's one of the situations that we get into because we are driven by evolution to privilege ourselves first. And altruism is really only a way of continuing to privilege ourselves by helping others helping us. So there's no such thing as pure altruism, and that's what creates a tragedy of the commons. That's why we wrote a chapter that you would find in the appendix about how these competencies have been augmented throughout evolution. We go from cephalopods and insects all the way up to humans to show that these were constructs needed by evolution, and we shouldn't be so enamored with our own selves. If anything, we should understand how much of a custodian, how much responsibility we have to the rest of everything because of our different abilities are above and beyond other animals. So that's really where I find some tension in me about how much humans have been driven by their evolution to be a certain way. I can understand why, but the hard part is transcending that. And it's the transcendence of it that's going to allow us to survive as a species. And if we don't, then we are going to get into deeper and deeper problems. So, all this to say, we all have a part to play. And the part may be big or small or whatever, but we all have a part to play. I hope we all play it.
That's right. And it demands courage, intellectual humility, and collaboration, open-mindedness, all of those lovely things that we should be, you know, reminded of.
Precisely.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me. I'm loving your book. I really am. And thank you so much for bringing it to our attention today. And we'll, you know, we're excited to share this interview and all of the insights that you've provided today with our school community. So thank you so much, Charles.
It's my pleasure, Kathy. And I'm very grateful for the quality of the questions. Thank you.
Thank you. This Get a Grip podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast, available to read and download from the Tooled Up site.